Catherine, this turkey tastes half as good as it looks. I think we're all in for a very big treat.
Save the neck for me, Clark.
Okay, Eddie.
Hello, and welcome to the Brick Pit. We're glad that you're here with us today. We're going to have a
super... We're thankful.
We're thankful that... Yeah. As you may have already surmised, there are a couple other co-hosts with me today. Joining me on the left, Cousin Eddie's Cousin Eddie, Josh.
That's a pretty accurate description. Thank you.
And the uncle that we all invite to Thanksgiving, but we never really talk about, Jason.
I make myself the center of the conversation.
That's right. And you also make yourself three extra plates, but we don't talk about that either.
Jason says, let's talk about politics as he's climbing out the car.
I bring a dessert, alcoholism,
uh-huh,
and codependency to the party.
It's an acquired taste.
Required.
Required. So as you may have guessed, this is our Thanksgiving special episode where we're going to talk about
Christmas.
The essence of what Thanksgiving is for most American families. And that is, in fact, family. We thought we'd frame this more specifically in kind of a typical trope that we see in a lot of media. And that's the dysfunctional family. And
so that means it's an entire episode of Tyler Perry movies.
Tyler Perry movies are pretty functional. That Madea keeps them in line, son.
Just when you think you can't take any more, there's another one right there. Always back to
the Madea verse.
If we don't talk enough, we don't talk enough about that. 90 minutes.
We really don't talk enough about Tyler Perry movies. Moving on.
What a shame,
Mr. Perry. Our apologies.
It's what conflict makes for good story, right? That's the essence. You know, as much as we like to pretend that heartwarming, happy ending stories are the essence of the holidays. In fact, no. And the reason that we all like dysfunctional family movies is because I suspect we all have a Cousin Eddie. We all have the uncle we don't like to invite to Thanksgiving, or the brother-in-law or whatever that we just can't stand. And it's universal because it's true.
And if you can't think of them, that's probably right.
If you don't know who the crazy person is at the table, it's definitely you. Anyway, without further ado, I thought we would just kind of jump right into classic takes. Now, these are not obviously going to be limited to, you know, Thanksgiving-y situations. We're going to talk about all kinds of dysfunctional families.
Because we're going to talk about more than planes, trains, and automobiles.
Yeah. The Thanksgiving movie, which obviously, I mean, it's, you know, as a quick plug, since it is the holiday, that's my favorite thing. I think it's really the only like core Thanksgiving
movie. There's a
right?
Thanksgiving Charlie Brown.
That's good too.
Show that nobody remembers that.
Yeah.
It's really crazy when Charlie Brown shows up dressed as a pilgrim and starts slaughtering Indians. Thank you, Park. It's really weird.
I think your memory of that's different than mine. But so we're going to talk about different kinds of families. And I think the important thing here, and this is what I'm going to challenge you guys to do, is by name, which character in each of these does it remind you of in your own family? And that way we can see who listens and who doesn't. Wait, Josh, we'll start with you.
Who are we in these, or who are in our family?
Who in your family?
I can tell you my family doesn't listen.
That's So then what's the harm in saying people's names?
It's a punishment in my house. Yeah.
Your uncle,
you don't do the dishes, I'll make you listen to the podcast. My wife included.
You just turn it on all the Google speakers in the house.
Gotta pump those numbers up, man.
Even better, you're playing a different episode in every room. That's the So it's not cohesive.
It's a true multiverse of madness.
Anywho, all right, Josh, kick us off. Let's give us a reference point here for a dysfunctional family.
I want to talk about a really underrated film, and it's the sad thing is we got to talk about an actor who we shouldn't have to talk about, because actors, some of them tend to be terrible people, and that makes me sad. But that is The Ref.
See these two people? I hate these people.
How can we both be in the marriage and I'm miserable and you're content?
Luck. It was Christmas Eve in Connecticut. I was minding my own business, breaking into this rich guy's house when... cops came. I took those two people hostage in that house that I hate. And guess what? Their relatives showed up. Why? Because it's Christmas Eve, remember? Remember how much I said I hated those two people? That's nothing compared to how I feel about the rest of their family.
Which is a holiday film. I think it's more Christmas, but it is a Dennis Leary vehicle, and he plays a thief that holds hostage a family of like kind of like Northeastern liberal Whole Foods eating Annette Bening and Kevin Spacey. But yeah, so it's a really dark comedy. It's a funny film, but there's any Dennis Leary vehicle is going to be basically be set up so Dennis Leary can do his rants. So the hilarity of this is like he really has a captive audience that has to listen to him rant. They're literally tied up and can't go anywhere. But it's like they're all getting ready for
this is going to be the plot of the Brick Pit, the movie. We're just going to remake
tied up listening to the
podcast. We're just going to remake this film. That's
it's going to be like The Strangers. They're going like, why are you making us listen to this? Because you were home.
Why do we keep having to listen to you berate Adam for liking Snatch?
I don't even know what that movie is. I don't get the reference.
There'll be a quiz at the end. Where did Adam go to school? So anyway, like there's a great rant where Dennis Leary is talking about grandmas, because the grandma is like a real piece of work. she's a real old battle axe, you know. He just like goes off on like how grandmas are supposed to be nice and stuff, and she's an old hag.
I thought moms are supposed to be nice and sweet and patient. I know loan sharks that are more forgiving than you. Your husband ain't dead, lady. He's hiding.
The whole point of the film is that these people are so selfish and preoccupied with themselves and how they look that they totally ignore their son, who's in distress and military school and getting all kinds of trouble and stuff. Dennis Leary, in a crazy way, brings them all together through the threat of violence, the American way. So pretty much it's like anybody's Thanksgiving. I guess I know Jason's seen the film. I doubt Adam has.
No, I haven't.
Because it's good.
Yeah, it's the standard trope where they, of course, assist Dennis Leary in escaping from the police at the end because
Stockholm Syndrome.
We like to call it, do they learn their lesson through
He's an all right guy after all.
Boy, I totally forgive you for pointing that gun in my face.
it's just a little light gunplay. What's everybody upset about?
I learned a lot about myself.
It's so funny. It was the lighter the whole time.
You still go to jail for that, Mr. Leary.
All right. So you mentioned something up front there about this twice in this conversation. You've used the multiverse or the whatever. So I actually want to talk about what I call the Garcia verse, which is the brothers Garcia, and they have a whole bunch of different shows that I like.
Andy Garcia?
No.
It's only Garcia I recognize.
Like Gregory Thomas Garcia is.
I don't even know who that is.
Well, you will once I say what the shows are that he's kind of famous for. It's Raising Hope, My Name is Earl, are his two famous, and they exist in the same universe, right? Those two shows, because there's a lot of crossover actors and characters who play the same. They're not the same characters, but they're the same actors. And so they, in a weird way, fit. And so he has a new show that just came out on Amazon's knockoff show or knockoff streaming service. It's not Prime, but I can't remember what it's called now, but Freevee. It's called Freevee.
And
it's like Tubi, but it's Amazon's version of Tubi. So anyway, so this was like they're going to be their launching board show for this new service. And I actually downloaded the app just to watch it. And it's 9 episodes. And it's got all the same, many of the same actors as Raising Hope and My Name is Earl. It's got Garrett Dillahunt. That's it. And Martha Plimpton. Those are the two.
I like Martha Plimpton.
Yeah. So she's great in this. But anyway, so if you liked Raising Hope and Earl, I would suggest you go check out the new show that's on. It's called Sprung on whatever Amazon is.
Governor's letting out a bunch of nonviolent inmates because of the coronavirus.
What the hell's a coronavirus?
The state has issued a shelter-in-place order. You need to stay in your home.
But we've been in prison. We don't have a home.
Yeah, I agree. It's a bit of a head-scratcher.
You can stay at my mom's place for a couple of years.
Dinner's ready!
You're living under my roof.
But you'll have to earn your keep.
You can join my crew.
I just spent 26 years in prison, and I'm not going back.
So you're out.
I'm not robbing someone unless they did something bad.
Since Mother Teresa will only steal from bad people, I took the liberty of writing up a list of douchebags in the area.
Should we be wearing masks?
It depends on which channel you watch. I'm waiting for Dr. Phil to chime in.
You don't spend 26 years in prison without learning a few things.
A perfect crime is a crime that nobody even knows happened.
He's in prison during COVID, mm-hmm. and they let everybody out because of COVID. Mm-hmm. And so he has no money and nowhere to live. And so he ends up with this family of it's Martha Plimpton and her degenerate son, who's also a thief. And, you know, it's a very much the Garcia brothers type. And in fact, one of the brothers is the son in the show. It's the he's
that's
the
a really confusing sentence.
So
this anyway,
we're
place in Alabama.
We're all from the Southeast. It is not a confusing sentence.
That's a fair point. Raising Hope is I don't know if either of you have ever watched the show at all, but it's one of my favorite sitcoms.
I'm aware of it.
I know the show exists. That time.
I will cede that it is a thing that was filmed and broadcast on television. Yes.
It takes a lot to raise a child, but for this baby, it's going to take a village.
Hey!
Idiot.
Why is there a baby in there?
Oh, I don't have a regular baby pusher thing yet.
Whose baby is that?
Mine. I don't have a bottle yet. I just got her a few hours ago.
Oh, hey. Nice car seat.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. It's a used one.
See that? Who used it? Baby Jesus?
Now that I have the car seat, it's safe to have her in my van.
Your van doesn't have a back seat. Where are you going to strap it in?
What do you mean, strap it in? She's fine. She's totally fine.
It's another Martha Plimpton, Garrett Dillahunt show. Got Cora Sweetchman in it as well. She plays the grandmother. Really stellar cast. The premise is the son, Jimmy, has a one-night stand with a woman who happens to be a serial killer. And so she gets pregnant and gets executed, and he gets the baby.
So this is a comedy, right?
Yeah. But his family is literally dirt poor, white trash. They don't know, his mom's like, we don't have any room for this baby. You know, you're going to have to figure it out. But they all move in together with the grandma and the mom and all this. And it's the family dynamics. It's a very dysfunctional family. The baby's name is Hope. So it's Raising Hope. Right. And so it's one of those sitcoms that it's really underrated. I think aired from 2010 to 2014 or 15. I think what's cool about it is they really do a good job of balancing the pathos of the show without they make you care about the characters, and they don't do jokes that sacrifice the characters. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, it's hard to do in a good writing where there's a lot of goofy characters that are already kind of dumb. Because if you're starting dumb, there's only one way to go, which is either dumber or smarter.
That's two ways.
I mean, that's what I'm going to say. There's only two ways to go, dumber or smarter.
If the lower class people are often portrayed poorly.
Ignorant.
Yeah. And so that's a hard thing to, because obviously there are people that make poor choices and end up in that, and you don't want to laugh at them.
Yes.
You know, you want to find the humanity in them.
Yes. And this is a great show.
And laugh at that.
And laugh at that instead.
I do remember, I've seen several episodes. I didn't watch it consistently, but there is that heart to it. Cause I remember there was an episode, Martha Plimpton's character, every year she tries to get them to do like a family Christmas photo.
Yeah. Family photo.
Because she works as a maid, and she's always mm-hmm. in these upper class houses, and they always have these fantastic family photos of them all smiling, you know, like ski gear and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Pushes the family every year to do that, and they're tired of it. And she finally tells them why, and they're driving. They all wind up just kind of listening to a song on the radio, and they start smiling and singing and laughing, and run a red light, and so they get their picture through a red light camera.
that's really funny.
That's the best picture they've ever had. Yeah, because they're all
that's really funny. I saw Jason watching a couple episodes of the show, and he seemed to enjoy it. So.
Were you watching him on the Steadicam? Is that what was
that? Sometimes I just like to watch Jason watch. You know?
That hole he drills out.
I call it the Norman Bates hole.
Careful now. It's a family show. So Jason, why don't you give us one of yours?
Well, sticking in with TV, there's a lot of great dysfunctional families throughout the history of TV. You got the Bunkers from All in the mm-hmm. Family, you know, Sanford and Son. But I think like the watershed moment really for television was Married with Children.
Introducing the Bundys of Chicago, a family like you've never seen.
Mom, Dad,
you're grounded.
Al Bundy, a real man's man.
Now I'm going to watch the news, and when it's over, I want some form of dead animal on my plate.
His lovely wife, Peggy.
Don't mind Al. It's just his time of the month.
They're two wonderful children.
You're disgusting. And you're failing five classes.
And their newlywed neighbors.
I love you, Marcy.
I love you, Steve.
I hate them, Peg.
They hate you, Al.
They're not the Cosbys. They're the Bundys. And they're married with children.
Hey, where can people hear about us talking about Married with Children, Adam? An episode you didn't listen to.
Wait, oh, that was the Fox episode, right? That's, I was about to say, didn't we talk about it in the...
We probably talk about Married with Children a lot.
Yeah.
We talk about it more than Ed Harris or what's it? Or Ed? Definitely more than Ed Harris. He hated that show. Anyway, yes. The Bundys, I think, were the final step to that kind of unvarnished American family. You know, like yeah. The journey started with the Brady Bunch with the blended family, and then it the terminus, the end station is the Bundys. The Brady Bunch was a seminal moment on television because how they were probably the first blended family on television.
Did they ever address, was it divorce or death? Like, I feel like they
murder, suicide. it was a strange situation. And then like they got together afterwards.
So if anyone's interested in if they want to hear more about Married with Children, they can check that out on the season one episode, Fox, the early daring years, which I don't have the episode number. I think it's season one, episode 12 is what it looks like. So that's where they can catch that. So to answer our earlier question.
But I think Married with Children definitely influenced not just other shows that came after it, like Simpsons and all that, but I think it really influenced Fox television in those early years. It kind of gave Fox its own voice that separated it from the other three networks.
Well, it gave license to show, you know, because before then, the dad was always supportive and the mom was always Susie Homemaker.
I just talked about the Bunkers. How can you say the dad
was
supportive?
Yeah, but
Meathead was.
Or the dad was always in charge, right? That was the dad ran the house. Even in the Bunkers, he was still the dad of the house.
All in the Family, I think, was more anomalous.
Yeah.
Whereas like Married with Children kind of solidified that as, I mean, we can get into most of Norman Lear's stuff was cutting edge, but yeah. Outside of Lear, you know, you had Schwartz doing, and then, you know, even pretty much network TV was pretty saccharine.
And it was really that transitional period where you started to see parents being, the domestic problems they had weren't, you know, the kind that were, I Leave It to Beaver I Love Lucy. It was more of they're kind of dumb or poor so like Roseanne would be an offshoot of this kind of concept where they're like most people, right? The families that actually represent what, you know, most American families.
You know,
are like,
it's funny that you bring up Roseanne and that none of us really brought that up as because I think the cultural view at the time for like the kind of mainstream view is that
we're laughing at them
that the Roseanne family was dysfunctional, but I think that they were actually pretty, they had problems, but they were pretty secrets. Together
yeah
family.
I would say that the first three, maybe four seasons, I can't remember exactly, that it was a very good show. It was a show about a lower middle class family just hanging on to that bottom run by the
right fingernails. but
you know, later on it became really kind of outrageous and mean, I would actually have to say, but yeah, those first few seasons,
it was flanderized
part of American life.
That's a good way to put it.
Really, very rarely got put.
Yeah, it flanderized pretty hard. It jumped the shark or whatever. But when I think of Roseanne, I think of like the first two or three seasons, because I still think very fondly of that show. Because even though, like, we weren't in that socioeconomic realm, like that was probably the most real family.
Right,
that I saw on television,
and there was into the family of the kids you went, like, even if you were a little higher or a little lower, most of the kids, if you went to public school in the South, especially,
right,
those were the kids you knew, right?
That was the family. Unlike Married with Children, it's like, you know, you knew there was love in that house, and even though they had problems and stuff, they had real problems, and it was,
yeah,
I would not call them dysfunctional versus the Bundys, which
most definitely dysfunctional,
right. Yeah, let's face it, none of them are good people, and they don't like each other.
And really, a lot of times...
And we are laughing at them.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a lot of times they work together simply because, not because they love each other, but simply because they're going against everyone else.
Like you said. They were the horrible people ganging up to, like, get a superpower of badness to get over on.
Yeah. And they would cut each other off the knees if they could.
Mm-hmm.
If it gave them an opportunity to do something, and they did it constantly.
Married with Children went the opposite direction of Roseanne, because Al and Peggy softened. Oh, you know what I mean? Like, they became more like acceptable and like lovable losers. But at first, they weren't really good people. They didn't really love each other. They were trapped in a marriage, and it was very dysfunctional. But at some point, people started rooting for Al. And much like Archie Bunker, very, very similar vibes going around that, you know,
Al, it was intentional, you know, like Al was made to be that way. He was made to be the guy that would do the stuff that you kind of wanted to do if you had the freedom, just to, like, you know, punch back at all the people that kind of putting their foot on your neck, you know. One of the great things, you know, recurring gags is him, of course, coming home and just talking about, like, something that happened at, you know, at work or on his way home. One of my favorite ones is he comes in and is like, I was coming home from work today, God knows why.
See, Adam, the joke is he didn't want to come home.
I still don't get it. Can you explain why that would be funny? I don't.
It's not. It's tragic. Okay. Kind of Shakespearean, if you think about it.
Oh, now see, I understand that reference.
Shakespeare wrote plays. We are the dysfunctional family of podcasts.
I love that. Also, like, one of their Christmas episodes, they did a "It's a Wonderful Life" parody, and it's, you know, Sam Kinison was his guardian angel. And showing them what life would be like if you not been born, and, like, everyone's life is better. And same kids, well, I guess I failed. He's like, what are you talking about? They've made life a living hell. I'm not letting them get away with this.
Another one I want to hit on, talking about horrible people and horrible families.
I want to stop you before we go too far, because
there's
a section we need to kind of keep away from here.
Okay.
Because of our one female listener.
Well, so she may want to turn off for the next few minutes.
Oh no, I don't want any part of this conversation, because I got Facebook that over this.
Well, I'll take all the heat this time, because
Josh and I are bowing out for the next 5 minutes. This is
so I'll just hit it.
The clock starts now. And you're a fan of the show.
So that's sort of. So I want to kind of contextualize. I have a lot to say about this, and I want to get it off my chest.
All right. I'll be back. Go.
So as you may or may not have guessed, for a long time listener, the show I'm going to talk about is what I think is probably the most widely watched contemporary dysfunctional family for women between the ages of 30 and 45 in America.
That's, like, super specific.
Yes. Like,
he commissioned the study for this.
And, yeah. And I know who you are, and you're listening to this show too, because demos are very similar.
I don't think so.
So all eight of you, listen up. It's Gilmore Girls, obviously, is what I'm talking about. And I think this isn't like my own hot take. This is nothing that I'm coming up with. It's new. But, you know, this used to be a show that we watched in real time when I was, you know, when it was on back in the early 2000s, I guess. And my wife and I, it became an annual tradition every autumn when this, when the leaves started falling and the temperature started dropping. When the
pumpkin spice was in the air.
We would watch Gilmore Girls. It was like her thing that she liked to watch. And I would, we would watch together. And I watched it. Before I knew her, would you know, because I thought it was a I thought it was an interesting family dynamic show because she was raised by a single parent, I was raised by a single parent. It's very, I saw a lot of similarities, right? And so when I was younger, I identified more with Rory as the daughter, and now that I've gotten older, I identify, of course, more with the, or as I got older, identify with the mom. But now I'm at the age where I'm actually identifying with the grandparents. I'm like, they're right, they were right the whole time, right? This is-
Tomorrow, our lawyer, Joseph Stanford, is coming by.
Ugh, crazy Sissy's dad.
That's terrible. Sissy was a good friend of yours.
Mom, Sissy talked to her stuffed animals, and they answered her.
Let's just start a new topic.
You're impossible.
She said a new topic, Mom.
Everything's a joke. Everyone's a punchline.
Okay, I'm sorry.
My daughter, Henny Youngman.
Sorry for that. A little trouble in our China office. Well, what did I miss?
I was being impossible, and then I turned into a Jewish comedian.
So, Rory, your grandfather and I thought it might be nice after dinner for you to go around the house and pick out what you'd like us to leave you in our will.
Why don't I ever bring a tape recorder to these dinners?
Oh, well, anything you want to leave me is fine.
Nonsense. You should have what you like. So just look around, and when you see something you like, stick a post-it on it.
Okay, you two have officially hit a new level of weird that even I marvel at.
You can pick out things, too, you know.
Oh, well, now it's way less creepy.
Did you hear that, Richard? Apparently, we're creepy.
Yes, well, you live and learn.
And so the hot take is, you know, on the internet, if you Google this or whatever, especially with the newer, where they came back and redid it with Netflix or whatever, it kind of distills this down a little deeper, is that they're the villains, right? They're the bad people on the show because they're very narcissistic. They treat everyone as if they're disposable. They're very privileged, and Lorelai is constantly claiming, you know, I'm the poor one, but her kids go into this private school that her parents are paying for, right? But to like Rory's best friend Wayne, how it's getting paid for it isn't really relevant, right? You know, like, it's like your best friend goes off to a $50,000 a year private school. Okay, I get there's family trouble there. Now you've got to go eat dinner every Friday night. How tragic for you, right? You know, but
at a very nice house.
Yeah. Meanwhile, she's got this, you know, authoritarian Korean mother that wants to send her to Seventh-day Adventist college, you know. So like it's well written. So the counterbalance to this is that it is written in a way that these are real humans, right? That they're multifaceted and they have flaws, even though they're the heroes or whatever. But on every rewatch, I see more and more things that are not like excusable behavior. like the veneer has worn off over rewatch, and every time I see it, I get a little angry. I think
your exposure to us, like we're like the salt in the air that has corroded your innocence.
Very good.
Gilmore Girls.
And I mean, for like a casual viewer, like on a first time go through, sure, it's a great little show. Like it's a mother-daughter thing. It's, you know, whatever.
But it has a dark underbelly.
But it has this like, yeah, subtext that when you really delve into it, it gets me mad. And so now my family hates watching it whenever I'm around because I'm like, see, like there's another example of them being just absolute trash. Well, I was just going to say, so as far as dysfunctional families go, the real thing here, I think this is the key. And this is actually, I think, perfect, is there's actually a lot of holiday episodes where they have to go to these holiday dinners and things. So that would be appropriate to listen to here. But the problem is none of them ever care enough to try to work on it.
they're happy being who they are.
Well, they're not. No, they're miserable. They just like to complain about it. Like it's everybody else's fault, you know, or they'll even say, like, or sometimes say, I'm the problem. I broke the system, and I broke up with him because I'm always bad with men. And well, go get a therapist, dude. Like,
I'm sure mom and dad will pay for that too.
Right.
Paying for school.
So the only thing that's interesting, there is one kind of like caveat to this. And this is why I say I kind of identify more with the grandparents, especially the grandmother more as I get older, is she's not great either, but she's really burned by her daughter and her granddaughter at various points. Most of her actions are retaliatory. She does some stupid narcissistic things too that kind of screw up relationship and things. But generally speaking, looking through the grandma's lens at the way she's perceived the world and where she fits in it and how she deals with problems, she's consistent and she tries to do what she thinks is right. Mm-hmm. They do a really good redemption arc for her, I think, in the when they do. So it was the one good thing about when Netflix brought it back and did the episodes. Emily, the grandma's redemption arc is that the grandfather dies. He died in real life. I can't remember his name, but he died in real life. So they had to write that into the story. And so after he dies, she moves to Nantucket and becomes a docent at the local museum. And she's vibrant and enjoying life and kind of unhindered from the expectations of being the rich housewife. And
so she kind of man the whole time.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. anyway, that's my rant on this. And that'll be the last time I ever speak of it until the next time we talk about it.
So this is all I'll say is my wife and now both my daughters watch the show. My part in this psychodrama is, yeah, I purposely say the wrong names for people. To aggravate, I go, oh, what's Rorke up to? What's Rorke doing? And it drives me nuts.
That's such a bad thing to do.
I don't know why I get such joy, but like that, they all get so hot. And like my wife watches Supernatural, and I call it the Dean and Malenki show. It's like Dean and Sam. I'm like, what are Dean and Malenki up to today? She's like, there's nothing. Like, yeah, it is.
So my version of doing that now, because I still have to watch it, right, is I will give constant facts about the other people in the show, like Alex Bornstein, who is a regular on the show. In real life, she was married to the guy who plays Jackson, and I would talk about their very public divorce and how she actually has to pay him alimony. Like, I give all these extraneous real-world facts about everything. You know, the interesting thing about The Stars Hollow is actually based off a town in Connecticut called Washington, and they're like, just shut up. So that's how I cope, Josh. I sympathize with you. Anywho.
So we just added ourselves as, like, just complete jerks in the problem.
I think we did at least 20 episodes.
When we die, our wives will go be docents and like live their best lives.
turns out we were the
jerks.
Jerk, why don't you go ahead and take the next one?
Gosh, well, let's go ahead and pop the cork on this one. We gotta talk about the Griswolds, the perennial family. There've been more people playing Rusty than there've been Batmans.
So here's the thing. I've not seen all of them.
Good. They're not I will go on record and say that Christmas Vacation is not the best.
Okay.
I like Christmas Vacation because it's kind of become a cultural touch point, and it's a fine movie, but the first two vacations are great, and I really enjoyed Vegas Vacation because my dad was a gambling addict, so I see
it's like a real family drama for you there.
My dad was we used to call ourselves the Griswolds growing up. Yeah, like that's, we totally identified with that. Even as a child, I was like, I feel like Clark Griswold.
What's wild is how much you look like him these days. Like, you really grew into it. So,
actually, I am Chevy Chase. This is the only way I can get work is doing a podcast under an assumed name.
So everybody,
he's Chevy Chase without the coke addiction and the racism.
See, you ruined it, Jason. I was going to say, I want everybody to pause right now. And this is like playing the Beatles backwards. I want you to hear the subtext of Josh's joke there. And go read between the lines.
I guess it was all offline. We were talking about how much of a jerk you have to be to get kicked off a Dan Harmon show.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So Chevy Chase, go to hell. What?
I would say I don't quite agree with you. I do think Christmas is the best one.
Yeah, of the ones I've seen, it's my favorite.
I'm partial to
Vegas Vacation.
Yes. Vegas Vacation gets dumped on a lot, and it's got some really funny stuff in it.
Yeah, I like the fact that they do make fun of the fact that there's a different Audrey and Rusty every movie. And Chevy Chase, I don't even recognize the kids, and he just like stares at them. And now, you know, the same with Real Men. It's a stupid joke. It's a bad joke, but it makes me laugh every time. And it's when they go to the Hoover Dam, and the guys there, you know, this. I'm your damn guide. Welcome to the damn tour. Is there any damn questions?
Yeah. Isn't that Brian Murray? Brian Doyle Murray? That
I don't think so. I think he just looks like Brian Doyle Murray.
That's his claim to fame.
So I still remember, like, Rusty's fake name was like Papa Georgia.
Yeah. Like, the fake ID.
Yeah. And it's like, that's just such a funny gag that he gets this really terrible ID and then it just keeps growing and growing. Like, he can't escape his good luck. Like, it's very Monkey Paul situation.
I also love the casino that Randy Quaid's cousin Eddie takes. When Clark's already spent all their money, and it's like one of the games, it's just like a dude has his hands behind his back and you got to guess what number he's got, how many fingers he's holding up.
which when you introduce your very young children to gambling, I'll just go and say right now, that's a great way to play.
Oh man. Yeah. So, but the Griswolds, like, they became archetypical of the dysfunctional family. Like, the Chevy Chase, as much as a terrible person he is a good comedic actor, and his Clark Griswold is the template for the bumbling kind of, like, really just wants things to go right, but he just things aren't happening right and he can't.
Yeah, he's got that Norman Rockwell sense of how family life is.
And yeah, he has a disconnect between what he wants and what is actually happening.
Great. Oh, beautiful. Good God.
I'm sure you know what it's about. Honey, let me tell you.
Where do you think you're going? See? Nobody's leaving. Nobody's walking out on this fun old-fashioned family Christmas. No, no. We're all in this together. This is a full-blown four-alarm holiday emergency here. We're going to press on, and we're going to have the happiest Christmas since Bing Crosby tap danced with Danny Kay. And when Santa squeezes his fat white ass down that chimney tonight, he's going to find the jolliest bunch of assholes this side of the nut house.
Clark, it's over.
Not according to Santa's watch, it isn't.
Now, come on, son.
Stay out of this, Dad.
Clark, I think it's best if everyone just goes home before things get worse.
Worse? How could they get any worse? Take a look around you, Ellen. We're at the threshold of hell.
We're going to speculate here a little bit. Every suburban dad that I know, anyway, at their core, they need that house to be decorated like that. They need the biggest Christmas tree. They need the right. They have that they need the Thanksgiving dinner to look like that Norman Rockwell picture, right? You know,
there's a weird thing that happens to you if you live in the suburbs, you get married and have kids, you start caring about the lawn. And my dad literally couldn't pay me to mow the lawn when I was young. I would refuse to do it. He would, like, you'd throw money at me. I'm like, I'm mowing the lawn, playing in Nintendo here, Dad.
It was always rolled up change, though.
He was trying to hurt me.
Throwing rolls of silver dollars. That thing weighs like 2 pounds, man.
He had a roll of quarters and a shotgun, like it was Young Guns. Best bucket of quarter I ever spent. But anyway, now it's like, you know, when it's lawnmowing time, it's like, get out the way, man.
I don't is know. That your catchphrase?
It's in time.
Get out the way.
It's lawnmowing time. I think the reason why I like Christmas Vacation the most is because of that sense that Clark wants to have this big family Christmas. He's inviting everyone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's all driving him insane. Yeah. To the point he actually just cracks.
But even in the midst of it, there is that really
you feel moment for him the whole time.
Yeah. Well, when he's in the attic, he's trapped in the attic and he's watching the old
family footage, mm-hmm. home movies.
And that's like a really emotional moment. And it's also like when you become an adult, there's two scenes that are like, put it all together. So Clark is watching these videos, these Super 8s of when he was a kid. And that's his reality, though that wasn't reality. That's his perception of the way things were. Mm-hmm. And then there's a scene later where he says, Dad, how did you do this? And he's like, a lot of Jack Daniels. Which, like, is exactly the situation. So, like, yeah. You realize that, like, as a parent, like, if you were lucky enough to have these magical Christmas and stuff, how much your parents were putting into it for you, the responsibility of that. And sometimes it's not fun, you know, right, to provide the magic to make the sausage, as it were.
With all these dysfunctional families, the thing that has to be the connective tissue that makes it not miserable to observe is you have to care about the characters, right?
Sure. You
have to have some moment of emotional connection or catharsis with them in some way. You know, that's what this provides. Anyway, Jason, what do you got for us?
Well, when I saw that Josh had put the vacation films on his list, it made me think of two movies that essentially take that template but go in different directions with it. And the first one is Little Miss Sunshine.
I couldn't help noticing Dwayne has stopped speaking.
Oh, yeah, he's taking a vow of silence.
We're going to California.
There are two kinds of people in this world, winners and losers. Sarcasm is the refuge of losers.
How much do I owe you for those pearls of
wisdom? Oh, that one's on the house.
Stop.
You're not going to charge me for that?
Laugh it up.
He started it.
Everybody, just pretend to be normal.
And you get a lot of what you got in that first vacation film. It's a road movie. You
know, someone dies.
Yeah, I say there's a dead body at one point.
Classic. It's a classic tragic comedy, dark comedy, you know?
Yeah.
There's never been a sweeter, more saccharine stealing a body scene in any film ever. Like, that's like, it's insanely heartwarming.
Yeah, it really is. And
I was bawling, and like later you're like, Jesus, they were stealing Alan Arkin's body.
Yeah, what gets me about this movie is when I watched it just last night, refreshing my memory about it, and it's like, man, this movie is so paint by numbers in a lot of places, but it's still very well done. And I think a lot of the heavy lifting is done by the cast. It's remarkably cast. Like I said, we talked Alan Arkin playing the grandfather, Toni Collette playing the mother, Red Kinnear's the father, Paul Dano is the son.
Yeah.
Abigail Breslin as the daughter, and then you bring in Steve Carell as Toni Collette's brother. It's before he really kind of took off in film. He was still that dude from The Daily Show.
Right.
It's really not the, as Josh would say, you know, the Steve Carell performance that everyone expects. It's actually very different. He's not, you know, some dim-witted or naive. He's very intelligent. He's like the foremost scholar on Proust's, French
author
and everything. When you're introduced to him, Toni Collette's picking him up from the hospital because he'd gotten depressed and tried to commit suicide. She brings him to the house to kind of keep an eye after. The youngest daughter, Olive, played by Abigail Breslin, had won like runner-up for some tiny beauty pageant locally. And then the girl who won couldn't go to the big one, Little Miss Sunshine, in California. They're in Arizona. They all get in a van and drive to the beauty pageant. You put all that dysfunction into an enclosed space for an extended period of time.
For some people, it's important to say it was a VW T2 microbus.
Yes. Well, they picked it for a few reasons. One, I think the guy who wrote the script had experience with it. Mm-hmm. But when he was writing it, he also very cleverly thought about it would be extremely easy to shoot a VW bus because they needed the space to put all the characters, but two, there are a lot of windows in one of those.
Right.
And so you can get a lot of coverage. There's some parts of it that I realize are kind of weak, like Alan Arkin's character. Yeah. He's kicked out of his retirement home because he decided to start snorting heroin.
Right.
Right.
You know?
And it can be a little slow and formulate in places.
But, yes.
But it, I mean, it, you know, but one,
it's the cast. Like I said, the cast really works. Paul Dano plays the son. He wants to get into the, I think, Air Force Academy.
Air Force Academy, yeah.
And so he's done this vow of silence until he does it. He's like 15. At the same time, it's like, is that really a good excuse? Like, he does so very well. There's two reasons to not give someone dialogue. They're either really bad actor, and you don't want them screwing up the dialogue, or they're a really good actor, and they're good at portraying those emotions through facial expression and body language. And Paul Dano is definitely the second. He's very, very well.
The good thing about that film, I think the general feel is that it is ultimately an optimistic film, but it does not shy away from, it's kind of in the same vein as Roseanne, that like,
yeah,
the problems that they're taking, there's a bit of heightened reality, but I mean the stakes are fairly low. It's people trying to cling onto something. It's all steeped in real problems and real reflection. Yeah.
And it's like, you know, they all have to give up something at one point. You know, Greg Kinnear is trying to get this, you know, essentially a self-help system that he's created, the 9 steps. And he's trying to get a book published and all this kind of stuff. And of course, the rest of the family hate, they keep hearing about the 9 steps and they hate it. But he keeps pushing for, and he loses that. Like, Bryan Cranston has a small role as the guy who's trying to sell the book. And he finally tells him, you know, it's not happening. No one wants it. No one's heard of you. You haven't done anything. It's dead. Right. And there's this really great scene because Alan Arkin is Greg Kinnear's father in the film, and they're kind of at each other because, like I said, Alan Arkin just doesn't back down off of anything in this. Like, he's the old man who says what he wants when he wants, no matter, you know, if it's politically correct or whatever. But there's a scene there in the VW bus driving down the interstate after Kinnear finds out about this, and Alan Arkin's been sitting in the back, and he makes his way all the way up to the front and puts his arm around him. Says, like, you tried something that no one else would do, and I'm proud of you for it. And, you know, Greg Kinnear at first is kind of like, yeah, sure, Dad. And just Alan Arkin still holding on to him. And then you can see that there's a connection there. Mm-hmm. That, you know, just all this animosity they've had and all this thing kind of breaks through in their father and son again. And that gets to the point, you know, Josh was talking about later, you know, Alan Arkin's character dies. And so they're in the hospital. And the hospital is just trying to, we're sorry for your loss. And I said, you know, a grief counselor would be here for you. Linda! You know, like they're being friendly and everything, but it's all formulaic to them. And they're talking about taking the body and all that kind of stuff. And Greg Kinnear's like, well, we have to get to California because we have to be there like this afternoon for our daughter to be in this pageant, because this is the thing. The whole family has latched on to getting her to this pageant at this point. And there's like, well, you're going to miss it. And that's when they decide to steal the body.
And so, like, the subtext of the film, and I think like the formulaicness of it is part of the underlying structure, in the fact you've got the 9 steps, you've got these people that are trying to fit in the mold or trying to live life through procedure. Like, I'm going to get into Air Force Academy, and I'm not going to talk. They're setting all these rules, and in life, that's not so. It's like they're getting slapped in the face with life. And it's at that moment, they're like, no, we're not going to follow the rules. We're not going to, you know, that they actually start to live and break free of the formula. That's when things really start getting kind of wild in the story.
It's everyone loses something. Like Toni Collette, like, she's essentially bearing the entire weight of the family and all their problems. She's overweight. She's supporting her husband, trying to get this 9 steps going. It's already, you know, it comes out in the film that Paul Dano's character is her son from a previous marriage. So she already has a failed marriage behind her. Paul Dano's character finds out that he's colorblind, so he's not going to be able to fly jets in the Air Force like he wants to. And there's this great scene where when he realizes that, he freaks out. And then Steve Carell's thing, like I said, he super depressed, tried suicide because he fell in love with one of his grad students. And then the grad student went and started having a love relationship with essentially Steve Carell's rival within this very small niche academic field of being a Proust. academic, you know, that guy was like the second in the field and Steve Carell was the first, and that guy winds up getting like a MacArthur Genius Grant. He like opens up a magazine in like the hospital or something like that, and that dude is also considered now the foremost scholar on Proust. it's very dark comedy, but it gets to the end, and of course the girl's talent that she's doing is dancing, and Alan Arkin's character is the one who choreographed the routine. Right. And it's to
Super Freak.
Super Freak. Yeah. And the dance very much matches the song. And then you have Beth Grant, who plays the a professional pearl clutcher with a southern accent. That's kind of her niche role, and she's trying to shut it down. And then the family gets on stage and dances with her. You know, that's the feel good ending and all that kind of stuff. And it's like I said, it's very formulaic in a lot of places, but it works.
It is a good example, just because, you know, I like to do these facts at the end. This would actually have been a really good movie to talk about on our season 2, episode 19, episode No Money, No Problem. Grossed $101 million on an $8 million budget, and was nominated for 4 Academy Awards and won a SAG Award. So, pretty cool movie.
And I think Breslin actually got supporting actress.
I think that's right, yeah.
She was like 9 when she did the movie.
Yeah, she did. Nominated for Best Supporting. I just looked it up. You're right. Yeah, very cool. The next one I want to talk about is a goofy movie that I'm not...
A goofy movie is not about dysfunctional family. It is goofy not. Goofy is like the greatest dad on film.
It is. So that was not the movie, but actually, now that you mentioned that, I want to...
I do want to talk about a goofy movie.
I want to talk about a goofy movie for just a second. When my daughter was, I don't know, whatever age, around the age that Max in that movie is, I showed her this movie, and I said, because it's a very, like, empathy, because remember, Max is essentially a butthole the whole movie to his dad.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then at the end, they like, you know, like he sees how he's hurt his dad. And so my daughter was going through a phase where she was being real butthole a lot of times. And so I showed her this movie and she goes, I don't understand why you're showing me this.
Such a jerk, dad.
Yeah, I was like, well, okay, that backfired.
Listen, little girl, I went to Cambridge.
The movie I want to talk about, which I only want to talk about because I recently watched it, and this is probably the only time we'll ever bring it up, is Step Brothers.
You're crazy. We're going to bring that up all the time. It's like the greatest movie ever.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Sleeping arrangements. Brennan, you're going to be sharing a room with Dale. Just until the two of you get jobs and you move out.
Hey, are you awake?
Yeah.
I hate your guts.
As soon as your eyes shut, I'm going to punch you square in the face.
This is the one rule of the house. Don't ever touch my drum set.
Don't touch it!
All right.
Did you touch my drum set?
Nope.
Why are you so sweaty?
I was watching Cops.
I think they're starting to like each other.
Okay, name your favorite dinosaur.
Velociraptor.
All right.
If you were a chick, who's the one guy you would sleep with?
John Stamos.
What? Did we just become best friends?
Yep.
The reason I'm couching it in these terms is because, generally speaking, I am not the biggest Will Ferrell fan. I mean, he has there's a handful of things I really like him in, but I am a John C. Reilly fan. I do like John C. Reilly quite a bit.
Will Ferrell is the champion. He even beats out Adam Sandler in movies that don't deserve to be as good as they are.
Yeah, I'd go with that. I think he kind of, yeah, yes. Talladega Nights. But see, that's the, okay, so you got like Anchorman, Talladega Nights, Step Brothers, and that kind of ends it for me, I think. All right. I mean, there's not maybe Elf. Elf is a very, very good one. We talk about that every Christmas on this show. But I love Elf.
The one Christmas show we did talk about that.
Yes, every Christmas. I don't know. That's what I just said. Anyway, Step Brothers, 2008 movie, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. Their parents meet, get married. They're adults. They're in they're 40, right? They're close to 40. But they have the aptitude of preteen boys, right? That's the gimmick.
That's the joke. But somehow it works for 2 hours.
You know, they each of them still lived at home with their divorcee or widowed parent, and then when they get together, it's the trope is the blended family, step family. I hate you. You're a jerk, with the body of 2 40-year-old dudes who can get away with a lot of gross fart jokes and stuff, right? All things equal, it's not a bad movie. It actually does make me laugh quite a bit. And
no, it's hilarious. It's
hysterical. Yeah.
Yeah. And I watched it.
I don't think that's remotely controversial.
Well, so what, here's the thing. So a lot of these old between 2000, so what?
The Judd Apatow years.
Yeah. 95 to like up to like 2015. There's a lot of these comedies that were made. The jokes don't land anymore. They're just not funny. Like they're more laughing at people than with people. And or the jokes are just, you know, they're just
mean spirited.
They're mean spirited, or they were jokes of their time. Right. That like the Budweiser frog. If you made a whole bit about the Budweiser frogs, that's not funny. Right.
Right. If we started riffing on Elon Musk and Twitter.
Right. 20 years from now, that wouldn't be funny, right?
It's not funny now.
Situationally topical. So, but this one seems to hold up. Like I watched it just, you know, like Jason, I watched it recently for this episode and I was surprised because I haven't seen it in probably, I don't know, 5 or 7, 10 years maybe. And so the one thing that I wanted to mention about this that is entertaining is that there's a couple of scenes where they have family meals where like the extended family come over. So like her other kid with, or, you know, like the mom's other adult son with his wife and children, right, or whatever. And they come to the family and they're having a dinner or whatever. There's always some kind of like, and that's played by Adam Scott, by the way. And
who is perfect, the perfect for that role. Snarky. Yeah.
Just real punky jerk, you know, whatever. And those dinner scenes are so realistic.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I need to say.
My takeaway from that is that like Mary Steenburgen, mm-hmm, her comedic chops are amazing. Yeah. She is one of my favorite things of Last Man on Earth. Like, yes, she is able to really do. She kind of hovers between deadpan and almost too broad, as well as, but having a pathos behind it the whole time. There's always meat in her performances. It's never hollow.
She's a really good straight woman, right? To the absurdity of,
yeah, she was in Elf wasn't she?
Too. Yeah, she's the,
yeah, and Elf basically, yeah, basically it was
the same role. Yeah, it's essentially the same.
And she nailed it in both, you know.
And she has this, and in Last Man on Earth, she has this like, mm-hmm, she has this as a character actor, this ability to exude realistic empathy in absurd situations.
Yes. and like just botheredness.
Yes.
Like such a good description. You could walk in a room and be like, oh my God, I'm bothering Mary Steenburgen. And she would say, like, what are you doing in my house?
Which is,
there's a restraining order.
Which is, I think, why she's, because it's, I mean, she kind of is like the perfect middle-aged mom, because that's mm-hmm, she's got that down to pat. Speaking of Last Man on Earth, we haven't talked about that in a year. We need to pitch it again. Will Forte, we're still waiting on you to respond to us.
What I like about Step Brothers is you have the John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell are like at odds at each other, like actual. If you brought two teenage boys,
mm-hmm, to
your new brother,
yeah,
it's like, I hate you. Like that scene where they're right, sharing a bedroom and they're going to sleep, it's just like threatening each other. When you go to sleep, I'm gonna punch you in the face.
I hope you better keep your eyes open.
Having shared a room with my brother for many years, that was
that was very
accurate. Well, and just in Will Ferrell has the ability to deliver a stupid line with such sincerity.
Well, and
like, also, we have so much room for activities. Yeah. Like
this. So I don't know for sure. I didn't do my research on this, but my expectation would be is that a fair amount of the stuff we see Will Ferrell do is just ad-libbed, right?
Yeah,
it's just probably improv.
John C. Reilly is pretty amazing at
that too, right? Too. Yeah, so I you put those two guys in a scene together and just cut them loose, right? And just let them do 20 takes to see which is the funniest.
Until you come to Sherlock Holmes,
yeah.
Or Holmes and Watson.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No. I think one of my favorite Will Ferrell jokes ever is from this movie, and it's John C. Reilly comes back home, and you know he had warned Will Ferrell's character before, "Don't play my drums."
Don't play my drums.
And you know, while he's at Will Ferrell's playing the drums and everything, and John C.
Why Reilly are you so sweaty?
Why are you so sweaty? No, I was watching Cops.
Cops doesn't John come on before okay. Clock.
Then there's the bit later on where the stepfather's like, you're like giving that big speech to Will Ferrell to like believe in your dream. And it's just like the craziest thing ever. It's like, I wanted to be a dinosaur when I was a kid. Will Ferrell, that's not a job. It's like this awesome reversal.
That's his other strong point, is to be able to state the obvious hilariously. Man, like, dude's got range, you know? Yep. I mean, he was a Stranger Than Fiction is blew me away. That is like, that is such a great film.
I've not seen that. And, maybe I should check it out.
You've never seen Stranger Than Fiction?
No.
It's not a comedy. It's funny, but it's not a comedy.
That's the way my wife describes me.
Yeah.
You laugh at it, but not for the reason you think.
It's a dramedy, but, okay. It's got Dustin Hoffman in it.
So it's basically Punch Drunk Love is what you're saying.
No, it's good.
Josh, to say that.
Just go into it blind. Just watch Stranger Than Fiction. It's and you'll say, huh, Will Ferrell can act.
All right, so let's talk about your last one there, Josh, because I'm it's exciting to me to
Okay. Well, yeah. I thought we were running out of time. So the
no such thing.
I think the modern day take on the dysfunctional family, I think like the new template is Malcolm in the Middle.
Enter a desperate world.
Thanks. All I can think about is how hard it is for my nipple.
Ow! Where life is cheap. I'm gonna die! Survival is a luxury.
There's meningitis. There are car accidents.
And the most terrifying adventure of all. Surviving your family.
Drink your milk.
It's lumpy.
Then chew it.
From the network that brought you The Simpsons.
Dude.
Comes a comedy that proves there's no such thing as a normal family. Malcolm in the Middle. Coming.
One of my absolute favorite shows of all time. Like,
I love, you know what's great about it? I love watching it with my kids. And I say, y'all want to watch the bad kid show? Because I'm very clear and they get, you know, it's like they get, that's how they vicariously get to be bad. So I'm like, look how bad they're doing. Cause you know what happened if you did that? this you got to listen to the podcast.
You know, that's that's the whole premise of NASCAR, right? You know, you can't drive 140 miles an hour, but you can watch other people do it.
But yeah, it's such a well-written show. And it talk about like the parents are just, I wouldn't want to say they're bad people,
no, because the kids are bad.
Yes. People.
Faced with what they're dealing with, they act with it. The parents act within a range of opportunity, a range of possibilities that is fairly restrained and actually makes a lot of sense. Like when you watch the show,
it depends, because Bryan Cranston, who's fantastic in this as well. Mm-hmm. I remember there was an episode where they were like cleaning up some stuff in the yard. So they'd rented a wood chipper.
Oh yeah.
And so they threw like the limbs in there and they're just all enamored by how the wood chipper worked. And when they
like, what else you got?
Yeah, they just started grabbing stuff and throwing it in the wood chipper. So he reminds me so much of a friend of mine's father, who was just as much as an instigator in our bad behavior as we were. Well,
what's funny about that wood chipper scene is like the penultimate thing they throw in is confetti. And it just goes in and comes out the same, and they're all like,
disappointed. Yeah.
That's such a funny guy.
Do you remember the last thing he threw in? Dewey said, can we throw in Reese's bike? And he said, just tell your brother he lost it. My favorite, how to your point, Jason, is the cold open where you can hear Lois in the background and she's going, oh my God, what is that? And you see Hal come running into the boy's bedroom and he goes, who wants to make $10? And Malcolm goes, for what? And he goes, no questions asked, $10. Okay. And he goes, I got him, honey.
Yeah. Like when I was younger, I thought Lois was horrible. And now I'm like, God, she is truly a saint.
Whenever she would be in jail in mass. I love the fact that the show beginning premise is that the eldest kid was so bad they put him in military school.
Yes.
Like this.
In Alabama. Yep. There's an episode where they let the local girls in.
Yeah.
And they just like start running wild. And like the commander, who's usually like super strict, is like, all right, hopefully they'll just burn themselves out.
Remember that? They're feral.
They just lock the door and hope they go away. Fantastic show. Todd Holland, I think, was the brains behind that show.
What's really fascinating about that is it was a strong burner from start to finish. Mm-hmm. Like
sharks to jump.
Yeah. Like even when they brought, they had Cousin Oliver kind of situations come in and whatever, but mm-hmm. it had consistently good writing, consistently good acting. Again, with a good sitcom, they never sacrificed the characters for a bit. That was the important thing.
Well, and I think at least for me, it's like contemporary at the time. I was just aging out of that mm-hmm. middle school, high school, but I identify with Malcolm. I wasn't a nice kid, right. Believe it or not. But I was also like in all the smart kid classes. So it's like I found a lot of self-reflection in that.
Yeah. And you always felt like you were surrounded by idiots, right? Either in your family or in the school or whatever. I first found out that this was not a universally loved show.
It's not?
No, I'll tell you, this is a not a very interesting story, but I'll tell it anyway. So I was
that's your MO.
Yeah.
I was very interesting stories.
I was in grad school when I was in the little cafeteria area that we had, and this show was on. And I was very excited. As we were going through the line, I was like, oh, I'm very excited. I'm going to go sit and watch Malcolm in the Middle. And we go over. And some guy's like, this show is just absolute trash, and tries to reach for the remote.
And that's when I
was like, and
you went full Malcolm.
You're not far from the point. I was like, have you ever seen an episode of this? And he's like, yeah. And he says, you know how, like, whenever the boys are wrong, there's just tragic consequences for the people that did that? He's like, He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, you're about to find out. I said, you will not change the channel. The side note to the, you know, how like all the backstory crap is the several of the, like Frankie Muniz, you know, he's recently come back into the media explaining the rumors that he had all these mini strokes and couldn't remember, which apparently wasn't actually true. That was blown out of proportion. Like the kid that played Dewey, Eric Persullivan, like, disappeared from the face of the earth. Like, he has there's nothing on the internet about him at all.
Well, like, yeah, and Bryan Cranston has like apparently like been interested in doing like a reboot.
Yeah,
and they can't. Everybody's like, cool. And Dewey's like, no.
Yeah. No, from what I heard, like Bryan Cranston said is. Bryan Cranston said, we literally cannot find him to contact him. like we don't know how to get to. So he was making like social media posts. If you know Eric Persullivan, let him know. We're interested in giving him a lot of money.
He's
on
the latest Unsolved Mysteries.
But great choice. It actually, I'm glad you did that one because it was going to be instead of doing Gilmore Girls, I was going to do Malcolm in the Middle. So it opened up the opportunity for me to talk about that. All right, Jason, let's pick one, either my last one on the list or yours, and we'll talk about
We're going to do mine because I've already set up. I had two, and they were all based off of essentially the structure. My last one of those, Captain Fantastic.
We've been in the forest about 10 years. We created a paradise.
They're going to be totally unprepared for the real world.
What's cola?
They have hot dogs.
How did you kill those chickens?
With an axe or a knife?
It was already dead or cooked.
We're going to file for custody of the children.
Will they take us away from you?
Nothing is going to change. We're a family.
It has comedic moments, but it's definitely not a comedy.
No.
And yet it still has a lot of the structure of The Vacation and Little Miss Sunshine. It's a road movie, stealing of a dead body.
Someone trying to get into school or, you know, some kind of elite next level training.
So, it stars Viggo Mortensen, and he's his father who has his kids, I think it's like five kids. He has them in the woods in Washington, essentially doing very militant, radical left wing training.
Yeah. This is a good movie.
Kind of like Deep Green kind of philosophy, but they're very off grid. A lot of overlap between far left and far right in the Captain Fantastic verse. They were probably anti-vaxxers.
But yeah, I mean, he's got his kids out in the wilderness, and the first scene is they kill a deer. And it's not like, oh, they shoot it with the gun or with the bow. No, the eldest son comes out Rambo style and slits the deer's throat with a knife. So that's like next level hardcore. But you find out like pretty close to the beginning that his wife has had mental issues. She's bipolar. A few months earlier, they finally, you know, sent her back to her parents, who are, of course, rich in New Mexico to go to an institution there. But she's committed suicide. It's eventually the kids talk him into letting them go to the funeral. And so they load up on a bus and they go, like I said, so it's a road movie and everything. They stop by at his sister's house. So you have that interaction with the family and everything. What you find out, though, is, you know, like these kids are super smart. They're super book smart, but they have no social, training or anything like.
There's a really good scene in there where you're right around that, where their kid like.
They go to like sell stuff. Like one of the ways they make money is they sell things at a local market and get money. And the eldest son is like helping Viggo Mortensen take stuff to the store. And these two young women come out and, you know, kind of start flirting with him. And he completely shuts down.
Right.
Because he doesn't know what to do. And of course, that inflames a little anger with the father. And the other son also doesn't like his father because he blames his father for not letting his mother get help sooner.
Right.
Because he overheard them arguing and everything.
And in that same part of the movie is when he was with his sister and she's, you know, like, you need to send your kids to regular school. And so he he then quizzes her children about just basic civic stuff and, you know, history and science. And they couldn't answer any of the questions. And then from like another room, he calls his like youngest in and they can answer all of these. And to Josh's point about being smarter than everybody in the room, right?
But yeah, like I said, there's definitely a disconnect with their ability to work within society because they, of course, have been taught to hate authority and capitalism and all that kind of stuff. Like they actually go and they have a predetermined plan to be able to rob food from a local grocery store on their
right.
You know, and then when they're done, he like quizzes them. What could we have done differently? Well, we all went out the same door, so that was, you know, we should have gone to the back dock too. That way, if anyone blocked the door, we had another exit. Like they're militant.
In a weird way, that family is like the competent Cousin Eddie family.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah,
because if Cousin Eddie was not stupid, you would have Captain Fantastic.
And so a lot of it, most of the dysfunction, though, is between the sons, because like I said, the youngest son, or not the son, the middle son, blames their father
for the mom's,
for the mother's, you know, deteriorating mental health and eventual suicide. And the oldest one also has received all of these acceptance letters to like Ivy League school. There's a fight then there with him leaving the family and going to these institutions with his father rails again. You find out that his mother had helped him do all that stuff because she wanted him to do something.
It's a tragic movie. There's a lot of sadness in this movie, and it is. I completely forgot about this until you listed it, I haven't seen it since it came out. Probably.
Oh, and it shows what I like about it is that it's very even keel far as it shows that. You know, obviously this guy loved his family and obviously they're very smart, but going to the extremes was not healthy because there were so many gaps that he didn't deem to be important, but whether you deem them important or not, they are, you know, and then there's the other side is the wife's family, you know, like they're portrayed villainously.
But they're not
through the father. Right. But then when you meet them and stuff, you're like, man, that's how, like you said, very tragic. Like that, this guy robbed this guy of his grandchildren.
Right.
You know, and that wasn't through no fault of his own. He was living his life as he felt he should. And it's so there's this clash of ideologies and the only people that are really, you know, everybody's hurt. But the real victims are these children because they don't. Viggo Mortensen made a choice. Those kids didn't make a choice, you know, and I think it's very non-judgmental on both sides. Yeah. It's kind of like this is the people and this is the story.
I also have to say, yeah, the father-in-law is played expertly by Frank Langella, who's great actor. A lot of that, you know, you have kind of at times like that stereotypical he's the evil guy because he's like, if you come to the funeral, I'll have you arrested and all that kind of stuff. But then later on, when Viggo Mortensen kind of softens, when, you know, his daughter almost dies, you know, almost breaks her neck because they doing a mission to liberate the middle son because he decides he wants to stay with the grandparents. And she falls off the roof and almost breaks her neck. The realization then hits Viggo and he's like, okay, yeah, you're right. We need to bridge this gap. And you see Frank Langella like be welcoming into him. You know,
right.
And, you know, it's really, it's like Josh said, it's not black and white. There's a lot of shades of gray and it's not
the choice you're expecting as a film audience, because typically in these films you're set up that this extreme way to be, you know, like, but like, yeah. And Viggo Mortensen like expertly portrays that, like all the BS in his head and all this stuff goes out the window when his kid's hurt.
Yeah,
like right. That weight, it's just,
that's the redeeming quality though. That's what switches it from a tragedy about somebody who is essentially insane to a redemption that makes sense in the context of his worldviews, that some things supersede philosophy.
Right.
There's that bit, you know, he leaves the kids with, you know, the father-in-law,
right.
And, you know, he leaves and he stops at a truck stop. And, you know, like I said, they've been living in the woods. So he's got this beard and everything. And then he shaves the beard and he's driving again. And the kids pop out. They had all decided they wanted to stay with him. So they hid in the bus that they drive around with. It's an old school bus. And so they talk about the fact that he shaved the beard, and the oldest son winds up using the same clippers to cut his hair real short, give himself like a buzz cut. And so there's this rebirth of both of them. Mm-hmm. Because the son winds up leaving and going to, I think, Namibia, just to kind of figure out, you know, what his place in the world's going to be. And he just said, you know, I just put my finger on a map and that's where I go. And then Viggo Morrison winds up actually building a regular house and having his kids go to school, you know, and that's like the final scene of just them sitting around the breakfast table.
Well, and what's interesting is like the reversal of cutting your hair short and militaristic is the act of defiance. Like, like
left-wing anarchists.
Right.
But there's this great scene because, as we said before, there's a stealing of a body. The father buries her, you know, the service is in a church, and, you know, buries her, and Viggo Morrison comes in and is like, no, here's her will. She was Buddhist.
And she wants to be cremated. Yeah.
And he's reading her will. And then after she's cremated, she wants her body, her ashes taken somewhere, preferably public, and then flushed down a toilet.
Mm-hmm.
So when, you know, the kids come together and say, no, we're going to stay with you. And there's like, we got to go save mom. We've got to do what she wanted. And so they dig up her body and they drive and they put her on a pyre. And then they go to the airport to see the sun off. And before that, they dump her ashes into a toilet in an airport. It's weird. It's also like, it's kind of like the end scene in Little Miss Sunshine, mm-hmm. where they all get on the stage together and dance.
Yeah, it's this weird world of obscene and wholesome at the same time.
Yeah,
there's a cognitive dissonance that
that's how people describe your style in general.
That's whenever they listen to me talk, they say, "Ah, this is horrible," and yet I can't turn away. I'm like, because
Josh
is
standing behind me with the shotgun.
Yes.
With that, I guess we should probably wrap it up for sake of time. But a couple things we didn't talk about. We didn't get to talk about Bob Wabaw's Wabaw from Arrested Development, which is a classic dysfunctional family.
Can I tell you something?
No,
you can't. I've only watched like half of the first season of that show.
That's tragedy. That's a real tragedy. Give it a second shot. If you have nothing else to watch over.
Jason likes it so much that I hate it.
That makes so much sense about your worldview, honestly. It is a very, very funny dysfunctional family show. And it saddens me actually in a lot of ways, frankly, it gives me hope, because when you finally discover that you do love this show as much as you will eventually, it'll be like a kid in a candy store for the first time. It'll be amazing to hear you rant about it.
I watched it. It was fine.
He'll never admit to like it.
You've got to really give it a good go. That and Archer.
There's always money in the banana stand. Hilarious.
It's the recurring bits that make it funny. So you got to like watch it with them. You know, it's
two seasons later. I love the fact that they'd have like on the next episode.
Yes. And that's not.
It would never happen. Episode,
yeah. But yet it's still canon. It's still continuity. Yes,
it's still continuity.
It's a little too mean spirited and snarky for me.
But the writing is so good.
But it's still mean spirited and snarky.
Yeah, the revival is definitely more.
You can cut all the new stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think you need to watch any of the Netflix revival stuff, but the original series is really funny. And Ron Howard as the narrator is just so funny because of all the connections and the connective tissue for people of a certain age, all the inside jokes to TV and comedy in general. It's just funny. And
Scott Mayo.
Yes, it's just the recurring themes of 70s television. Anyway. Raising Arizona, Royal Tenenbaums, Meet the Parents were the ones we didn't get to that I would have wanted to talk about. But that's okay, because you know what? There's always next Thanksgiving, and we can try to avoid each other again till then. If you really, really have a horrible family over for Thanksgiving and you want to shut them all up or make them leave early, I would strongly suggest you put this on. This will air just before Thanksgiving. And I can't think of a better way to show your family what you're into, this podcast. And so they'll think very highly or very negatively of you, depending on your relationship. So
either this or put on Meet the Feebles. And
so
you'll never be bothered by family again.
With that, Jason, would you mind taking us out?
All right. So if you want to get in contact with us, Adam's OnlyFans pages, you can email us.
The Thanksgiving Gobbler.
Our email address is brickedpit@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, the Bricked Pit Podcast. And of course, our main page, anchor.fm/brickedpit, for all your Bricked Pit goodies.